Good. Anything else? So we are not switching the exercise. The doodle poll seemed to be non-conclusive. So the two best options would be either the option we already have or a different one. And we're going to keep the option that we already have because some people have already scheduled their calendar according to this schedule. So I thought the better option is to keep what we already have instead of switching. Okay, good. So if you decide to go for the early exercise, you might have very good supervision because only few people are there. It's Wednesday at 9? Not 8? It's in Univis, so you can look it up. It won't be changed. Yeah. Okay, good. So today we are going to do a refresher course, and we will talk about a tool that is called Singular Value Decomposition. And as you will see, this is a very powerful tool, and we use it in image processing all the time because it allows us to solve linear problems quite efficiently and quite robustly. And yeah, we will talk about that today. Okay, so should we wait a bit? Okay. Okay, so let's start. So welcome back to medical image processing, interventional medical image processing. Okay, there's still people coming in, but have a seat. Don't worry. This is a refresher course anyway. So today we will talk about singular value decomposition, and there is a certain rumor that is between the students every semester. There's this rumor that if you're in the oral exam and you're not exactly aiming by asking very strange questions, then probably the answer is SVD, because probably there's something linear in the topic that we're discussing about, and then SVD might be a good option to solve the entire problem. Good. So what is SVD? SVD is a powerful tool. It's a matrix decomposition. But first, let's reconsider what matrices are and what we're doing, what we might use the SVD for. So let's say we have a matrix. So we start from the very basics. And of course, we will then go into more detail. But let's consider what a matrix is. Typically, you have a matrix, and you call the matrix probably A. You will realize that this is an advanced course, so we are switching the symbols from time to time. Sometimes it's A, sometimes it's M, sometimes it's B, but generally it's a matrix. And because this is an advanced course, we expect that you still can follow even if we switch the symbol for a specific matrix. Yeah, don't get too much confused. If you get confused and I'm switching symbols too often, please just ask. Yeah? But let's call our matrix A. And our matrix A is composed of numbers, and it has a specific dimension. In particular, it has m lines and it has n columns. This is how our matrix looks like. And now you can also write down this matrix in components. So your components would be denoted as minuscules. So we are not using capital letters. So generally, if we use capital letters, we are referring to matrices in this class. And if we use bold notation, so matrices are capital letters and bold, and vectors are small letters, and they are also bold. So this is generally bold is some kind of entity that has more than one dimension. And if we have scalar values, they are just small letters and they're non-bold. Because I'm having trouble writing bold letters onto the board, I will mark vectors with a small arrow. Okay? So this is generally the notation, and most of the time we keep this notation in the class. So if it's not kept, then we need to fix it on the slide. Or I just forgot to put an arrow. So then please remind me of putting an arrow somewhere. Okay, so you have a matrix, and it's composed of scalar values. And as I just said, it has n columns. So this needs to go to A1n. And here we have the rows, and we have m rows. So this goes to am1. And then, of course, the last entry in our matrix is amn. So this is our matrix. Okay. So if I now multiply this matrix with some kind of vector, let's say I multiply my matrix with a vector x, then I can essentially write this down. So I could rewrite this matrix also as a set of column vectors, and then I would have only vectors ai, and now I'm using the arrow to mark my vector, and I have a couple of column vectors, and this goes up to an, okay, because I have n columns. So this is also a way how I can represent my matrix. Now I put all of the vectors here because I can summarize each column as a vector. Then I can rewrite this matrix here. And now if I multiply my matrix with some kind of vector x, what I do get is something like, so now my x is of course again a vector. So I need this arrow here, and it has a certain number of entries. And you can rewrite this then as the column vectors of our matrix, so A1. And A1 is then multiplied with the scalar value x1. And so ahead, so you can do A2. And this is multiplied with the scalar value x2. And of course, you can continue now up to an times xn. So x needs to have n entries, the vector. Otherwise, we can't do the multiplication. And now what you can very nicely see from this is if I do a matrix multiplication with a vector, the vector essentially tells me how to mix the columns of the matrix. So this is a weighted sum, and you can interpret a weighted sum as a kind of mixture between vectors. So let's say you could compute something similar like a mean value from this. If you put in the vectors and you want to compute a mean value of vectors, you could put them all into a big matrix, and then you multiply it with a vector x that has 1 over n as the entries in every dimension, then you would compute a mean value. You see that? Because it would then boil down to a mixing with equal weight of all the column vectors. And of course, this is very useful to know this, because then you can also find things out about a matrix by multiplying with certain vectors. So let's say you have some piece of software, and it's poorly documented. Then you ask the guy, and the guy is busy. He says, well, it does the trick. It's a fabulous piece of software. I made it. I'm really a cool guy, and nobody else understands my code. But you know that what the software is supposed to do. and he already told you that it is actually a matrix multiplication. So in this case, you don't have to figure out what he's actually implemented. Maybe he doesn't even show you the source code. Maybe you only have a library, yeah? So you only have access to binary data. But if you want to figure out what this kind of software does, and you can give him x1 to xn, and you want to figure out A. Do you know how you can figure out A? If you only have access to some software that will give you the elements, but you can give the elements of X to that software, and it will return you the result of the matrix multiplication. So how can you construct A then? Yes? Exactly. You feed in the basis vectors. So you feed in vectors that are composed of a single one, and the rest of the entries are zeros. Yeah? And there's a set of n basis vectors. Here in this example, we have n equals 5. And you put in all those basis vectors, do the multiplication once. And by this, you can reconstruct the individual column vectors of this matrix. So this is actually something which, this shouldn't happen, but at several occasions, software is complex, and then documentation was not performed, or it's lost, or there's even guys who do not document the software on purpose, just to make themselves to make people who use the software dependent on them. So people, he can't get fired because nobody else understands the software. And there's really people out there who try to do that to get in a particular position of power. Yeah? But of course, if you know what the software is supposed to do, you can estimate how to get this result, in particular if it's a linear system that the software approximates. You can easily figure out the column vectors here, and then you can implement your own version very quickly. Occasionally this actually happens, yeah? That people don't understand their own software anymore, or software by other people, and then you have to figure out what's going on because some documentation was lost. And if you don't do exactly what the other piece of software did, the test will fail, and if the test fails, then everything is doomed. So you won't be able to run the new version, and then there's the release date, and you have to find a solution quickly. Maybe this could be one thing you think about. Okay, good. So now that we have discussed matrices, one thing that may also be interesting is norms. So typically what we do in this class, if we denote norms, let's only stay with the L2 norm right now. We denote it like this. So if we have a vector, and we call the vector again x, and we compute the norm of this vector, this essentially means that we square all elements of the vector, add them up, and take the and add them up. So this is the square of the 2 norm. If you remove this 2 up here, you would take the square root. But often we take the square of the norm because then we don't have to fiddle around with the square root. And the nice thing is, you can easily rewrite this also again as in vector notation. So what we very often do in this class is we rewrite this to x transpose x, because this is a scalar product. So this is an element-wise multiplication. And then you add it up. So this would be nothing else than x1 to the power of 2 plus x2 to the power of 2, and so on up to xn to the power of 2. So, also, this is a kind of notation that we very commonly use in this class. And once you get used to this, you will like this a lot because it's a very short notation and you don't have to, so everything is just a matrix multiplication. It's just, and you don't have to fiddle around with different symbols for scalar product or matrix product or whatever. So this is a very nice of denoting a norm. Well, now that we have talked about this, one thing that is quite interesting is when also this projection onto base vectors. So let's say you want to build a rotation matrix. Yeah? This is also where this kind of way of thinking is very useful. So let's say it's 2D, and you have some point, and you have this point here, and you want to rotate it by a certain angle such that it is then here. Let's call this angle alpha. And now you want to build up the rotation matrix for this thing. Yeah? Then you can think about what happens. So this is, again, the same thing. Our rotation matrix is some matrix R. And R is, of course, composed of R11, R12, R21, and R22. This is what we want to get. And now we want to know what are these R's. You might remember rotation matrix is something with sines and cosines, but it's always difficult to memorize. So if you memorize this trick, how the matrix multiplication works, you can very easily figure out what the elements of this rotation matrix needs to be. So if we want to figure out the first column here, we, of course, need to multiply with 1, 0, because 1, 0 will give us the first column. So this will give us the elements R11 and the element R21. Now, I know this multiplication will produce these two entries. Now I can also think about this vector. How does this vector look like? If we say our first dimension is here and our second dimension is here, where is the vector 1, 0 in this image? If this image is too small, I can also draw it bigger. So if the vector is 1, 0, it must lie on the axis, because one entry is 0. So it needs to be located somewhere on the axis. On which axis is it? On this one or on this one? 1. It's on axis 1. Yeah. And how long do we need to go? 1. Exactly. So we need to go one distance element, and I just define one distance element as this. So this is 1. So this is our vector. And now you have to think about what our rotation will do. Well, our rotation will rotate this vector by the angle alpha. So it will put it here. So can you tell me what happens to your vector 1 if you... Can you tell me the coordinates of this point? Yes? So this is cosine alpha, sine alpha. Okay, good. This is cosine alpha, sine alpha. And now we need to figure out the second. So we already know that our matrix will have the cosine alpha here, and it will have the sine alpha here. And now we still need to figure out these two elements. And what do we do to figure out the second column? Yes? You feed in the second base vector. Where is it? On the other axis, and it's again here. Okay, and now we rotate this guy by alpha. Now we have 3 instances of alpha in here. This is a pretty busy figure. Okay, and do you know the coordinates of this thing here? Yes? This is minus sine alpha and cosine alpha. Exactly. And then you have already constructed your rotation matrix. So this is a very nice trick. If you can't memorize how a rotation matrix looks like, this is a very nice trick how you can actually, in a couple of seconds, you can derive your rotation matrix. And it's not because we just memorized the formula and memorized where the minus is. It's because we are just using the properties of the matrix product to construct this matrix. We know that the projection of the base vectors will give us the column vectors of the matrix. And this is how we can reconstruct our original matrix. OK? So this is all very basic, right? So you all know this, and this is a nice refresher. Now, let's see, what do we have here? We have this inner product here. Yeah, so one thing that you also can think about if you consider a matrix. Okay, so this is on video anyway, so you can copy it from the video. So you don't have to take notes. Or should I go to the other side? Do you want to have a vote? You don't want to have a vote. Okay, good. Another way of thinking about a matrix is, now we stay with this 2D example. So what you can also think about is, let's say I have a matrix A, and you want to visualize the effect of the transformation. Then you can, for example, take all the vectors. So you take the vectors, all of the vectors that have the length of 1. So if you take all vectors in 2D with the length of 1, you get something like this. And this is called the unit ball. So you have all vectors with length of 1. And this is the unit ball. And now you can think about, if these are the vectors x, you can interpret the effect of your matrix by looking what the matrix does to the unit ball. So this is x. This is the set of x vectors. So let's call this maybe xi. And then you go over here, and you apply your matrix. So what you visualize here now is A times x of I. Yeah? So this is all the vectors multiplied with A. And because this is a 2x2 matrix in our case, you will get, again, a set of 2D vectors. And now, dependent on how this looks, you can make some interpretations of the matrix. So for example, if you have an identity matrix or a pure rotation matrix, it will look again like this. Because if you rotate the unit ball, it will still be the unit ball. You won't see the effect on the unit ball. Or you could have something which looks like this. Then you suddenly get a line. What's that? What happened here? Yeah, this is a rank-deficient matrix, exactly. And then you can also have cases where you have a scaling and so on, or you have almost a rank deficiency. So in this case, you have a very long extent into one direction and a very short extent in this direction. So this is almost rank deficient. And of course, you can now think about this. Now, if you try to invert this, so can we invert this? Can we rotate this such that we get this again? Yes. Can we invert this? Well, theoretically, yes. But there may be some numerical inaccuracies, in particular if we have small numbers involved. Can we invert this? Can we map a line to a circle again? No, because we would have to assign this point two different locations, and we can't do that by matrix multiplication. So these are just very simple ways to think about matrices and what the matrix does to your points and vectors. But this is very useful if you have such kind of images in your head when you think about some equations. Yeah? So this is very nice. Okay. So we will go back to this example after we have introduced SVD. And essentially you can, oh no, let's stay with this example. So essentially you can think about any kind of these transformations I could write by a series of transforms. And I can construct a series of transforms that does the following. So we have a set of points. So let's stay with an example that we want to get some kind of result that looks like this. Okay, so we want to get some kind of ellipse. So what we can do now is we can break this down into a set of transforms. And the first transform is going to be a rotation. So we first do a rotation. Now let's call this rotation matrix U. And we apply the rotation. And we know if we apply a rotation, our unit ball will still look like a unit ball. So we could do some kind of rotation. But we do the rotation such that the next matrix will apply the correct transform. And the next matrix, and let's call this maybe sigma, and sigma will be a diagonal matrix. Now, if we do a diagonal matrix, it will only have the indices, it will only have elements on the diagonal. So we will have sigma 1 and sigma 2 in our 2D case, and those two elements will be 0. It's good that I'm telling you this, because you probably can't read what I'm writing there. No, but this is a sigma. This is clearly a sigma. And this is clearly a 0, okay? So this has only elements on the diagonal. What will a matrix do that has only elements on the diagonal? Exactly, it will scale the base vectors. So what this will do, it will apply a kind of scaling. So let's say we stay with this example, then it will only make something like this. So it will deform our unit ball. If we have rank deficiency, we need to compress one dimension completely. So one of the elements on our diagonal needs to be 0, because then we will have compressed it and killed out that dimension. And then, if we want to go back to this kind of representation, what you need to do is you need to rotate again, and then we rotate again to this shape, and we are back to the example that we have. And we call this operation V transpose. It's again a rotation matrix, a 2x2 matrix. And now we have already shown you the singular value decomposition. Because what the singular value decomposition does is essentially every matrix multiplication can be expressed as a series of a rotation, a scaling, and another rotation. And with the singular value decomposition, you are computing those three matrices. This is what comes out of the singular value decomposition. So don't be afraid. We won't be implementing singular value decompositions. We won't play with the numerics of singular value decomposition. We will use it as a tool. You can find SVD in most toolboxes, and you can just call it, and you hand over a matrix. And what you get from the singular value decomposition is the set of matrices U, sigma, and V transpose. And that's basically it. And now the nice thing is, from the set of matrices, we can learn quite a lot about the matrix itself. And of course, we can reconstruct the original matrix just by multiplying the three matrices back into one matrix. And this will give you the original matrix. Okay. So, general remarks. Let's start with the slides a bit. General remarks. Okay, so this is a very powerful tool. I think I already said that, and it might be quite relevant for the oral exam that you know those three letters, SVD. And it's a numerical method in linear algebra. It's been invented already in the 19th century. And for computer vision and for practical applications, it's been used for practical application by Gene Golub, and established in computer vision by Carlo Tomasi. So Carlo Tomasi has published a very, very, very nice paper about factorization to compute structure, so to compute camera motion and the 3D location of points from the same set of data. This is very nice. So you have a sequence where you track points, and with the factorization method, you are able to reconstruct the calibrated projection matrices of the camera. So you're calibrating your cameras, and you're reconstructing the scene at the same time. And you can do that because you use the SVD factorization method. So the nice thing is that essentially the projection process can be decomposed into a set of points, that is the one matrix, and a set of projection matrices. And then you have two matrices that you somehow have to estimate. And you can use this singular value decomposition as an initialization for this algorithm. And structure for motion is very, very popular and has been used in a lot of applications. And the nice thing about this kind of method is it's very robust and it's very simple to use. So if they have the library implementation, you just call your library, you get your matrices, and it allows you to learn a lot about the underlying structure. And we'll use it in several occasions in this class. And it's very useful. So what can we do? Of course, we can compute singular values with the singular value decomposition. And the singular values are exactly those diagonal elements of this matrix sigma. But you can also compute the null space. So if you have sets of equations that have the form A times X equals to a vector of zeros, then you can compute the solution space of this equation of SVD. Or you can compute the pseudo-inverse. So if you need to solve a system of linear equations that looks like this, and you want to know X, you can use the pseudo-inverse. We will also look into that, how to do that. You can solve overdetermined linear equations with it, and you will get solutions that will be least square optimal. You can compute condition numbers with it, so we'll also look shortly into what condition numbers are. And you can enforce rank criteria. So let's say you know that the matrix needs to be rank deficient, and you have estimated a matrix that is not rank deficient, then you will know that you this is essentially caused by noise, and you can enforce the matrix that is least square optimal that has the rank deficiency. Good. Well, we already talked a bit on the geometry of linear mappings. This is essentially the same that we already have on the slides, that you can select a column vector from a matrix by this multiplication. You can reconstruct the rotation matrix here. So this is also what you already did on the board. And this is generally the effect of a matrix multiplication. So we also did that on the board. So I'm skipping over of this form. Now let's go to some definitions. And we put these definitions here on the slides. So it's useful to know the definitions, but usually I would not ask in a kind of oral exam, write down the exact definition of the singular value decomposition. But I want you to understand how it works, and you probably need at least parts of the definition to explain how stuff works. Yeah? So you should know that a singular value decomposition is a decomposition in three matrices, and what the matrices do. Like one is a rotation matrix, and then you have the scaling and another rotation. Yeah? So this is what I'm expecting, and of course you should know that sigma is a diagonal matrix. But you don't have to, if you know how stuff works, you can also derive the definition. Yeah? You will be able to produce the definition, but not word by word. So you will have to be able to explain things, and you will have to show that you understand the methods. Okay, so let's have some, so I'm showing the slide and I didn't explain anything, but this is exactly what I just said, yeah? So this is that we can decompose A into three matrices, U sigma V transpose, and sigma is a diagonal matrix, so here we are using this diag and only the singular values on the diagonal. And one property that's interesting is the so typical implementations of the singular value decomposition, they order the singular values such that the highest singular value is sigma 1, and the lowest singular value is sigma p. And it needs to be greater than 0, because otherwise it does not have rank p. So this is a matrix of rank p, and therefore it must have a non-zero. I think the rank is r. So this is greater equals 0. So it has p singular values, but if it has rank equals p, the last singular value needs to be non-zero. And if you want to compute the rank of a matrix, you do the singular value decomposition, and then you just count how many non-zero elements you have in the diagonal. So number of non-zero elements in the diagonal will tell you the rank of a matrix. If you do the singular value decomposition, you suddenly have a lot of information about this matrix essentially for free. Okay, some properties. This is what I just said. The rank of a matrix is just the number of non-zero elements. So you count the number of elements that are greater to 0, and they are R. And then you can define something which turns out to be really useful if you work with real data. You define an epsilon rank of a matrix. Most of the time, you might not have exactly 0 at the singular value, but you will have a very small number. Let's say 10 to the power of minus 3 or 10 to the power of minus 5. And then you can say, well, my epsilon is 10 to the power of minus 5, and everything smaller than 10 to the power of minus 5, I consider a 0. So then I can define the numerical epsilon rank of a matrix, and this is then the number of singular values that are greater than the value epsilon. Often very useful if you have noisy data, real data, you will run into problems. If you, let's say you have a singular value with 10 to the power of minus 7, then this is almost 0. And now imagine, well, we will see what happens if we invert this matrix. We will see that in a bit. So you can, of course, construct your matrix A again from all of the singular element singular values that are within the rank of the matrix. So we don't have to add up to P here, because all the singular values greater than R will be 0. So we only iterate from 1 to R, and then we have this weighted summation of the two vectors from our matrix. So if you think about UI times VI transpose, these are two column vectors. So if you take a column vector and a transpose column vector, this will give you a matrix. And because this matrix is constructed by a single multiplication, this matrix will have the rank of 1. And now you can easily follow. Now I have a set of rank 1 matrices that I somehow weight with a non-zero value and add them up. Then, of course, I will get a matrix of the rank R. So this is, of course, all of you know this. This is just a refresher why this kind of transform is very useful. And then you can also compute the Frobenius norm of the matrix. So Frobenius norm, now we have some F here for our norm. And this is all elements in the matrix squared added up in the square root. And you can get that from your singular value decomposition just by squaring the elements on your singular values and summing them up. This will also give you the Frobenius norm. Pretty clear that we get the Frobenius norm here, because essentially all the scaling that is applied is in our singular values. So we can estimate or we can compute the Frobenius norm only from the singular values. So we don't have to iterate over the entire matrix. If you already have the singular value decomposition available and you need to compute the Frobenius norm, you can implement this, because this will be faster than this, in particular if you have pretty big matrices. And matrices that are not orthogonal. So let's say you have a matrix and it's 1,000 by 3, then you know it can have at most the rank of 3. And then, of course, it's more efficient to iterate over the 3 elements rather than iterating over the 1,000 times three elements. Then also some interesting properties are that if you multiply your matrix A with the vector V, you will get the scaled version of U, and it's this scaled with the singular value. And also this property holds that if you have A transpose times UI, you will get essentially VI scaled by sigma I. And the column vectors of U are the eigenvectors of A transpose A, and the column vectors of V are the eigenvectors of A transpose A. So this is, so what you have in your two matrices U and V, because usually if you have generally matrices, they don't have to be matrices that have the same length in both dimensions. And in this case, you can still construct matrices A transpose, and A transpose A will always give you a matrix that has the same length on both dimensions. And then you can perform an eigendecomposition, and the result of the eigendecomposition will give you the eigenvectors. So the so UI are eigenvectors of A transpose, and VI are eigenvectors of A transpose A. Also very useful properties. We can compute the null space, so the kernel of a matrix, and the kernel of a matrix is spanned by the column vectors of V. So, and the column vectors of V that have zero singular values. So if you know this is a rank deficient matrix and you want to solve this kind of equation, you do the singular value decomposition. Let's say it's a 2x2 matrix, then the rank deficiency has to appear here in this value. So the last column of V will be the null space. So this is your solution space that will produce, that will hold this equation. This will only work in rank deficient matrices. Okay, and then the range of matrix A is spanned by the column vectors of U. So this is the image space where you are projecting into with your matrix. Null space and image space. Okay, good. Then we have an example, and you can play a bit with this example if you copy those numbers from the slides, and then you open some software, let's say you're using MATLAB, and you type in this matrix and you type SVD of this matrix, then MATLAB will return you three matrices and they should look like this. Now we have learned already a lot about matrices. So what does this decomposition tell you about this matrix? Yes? Yeah, it's almost rank deficient. So this value is very small. So this matrix is almost rank deficient. So if you look at this matrix, it's hard to tell whether this is really rank deficient or not. But if you type in the SVD and you take a look at these three singular values, you immediately see that this is almost rank deficient. And now you can compute the kernel of the matrix just by taking the last column vector. And this will give you the kernel, and of course the kernel forms a line here, and the range is given. So this is the matrix. So this is the column vector of V that corresponds to the very low singular value, and these are the two column vectors of U that correspond to the rather high singular values. This will give you the range and the kernel of the matrix. We generally call problems ill-conditioned if you have a pretty bad condition number. And you can compute the condition number by looking into the effect of inverting the matrix, and then, so you take the matrix inverse and multiply it with the matrix itself, and ideally this should give you the identity. And you can compute this condition number kappa, and if you have a singular value, this will go towards plus infinity. Now this is a bit bulky, actually. Now you need to compute the inverse, but we can do this much faster. So if you have your singular values, you can compute this condition number simply by taking the largest singular value and you divide it by the smallest singular value. And now you immediately see why you will have plus infinity as a condition number if you have rank deficiency, because your smallest singular value will be zero. And if you divide something by zero, it goes towards infinity, and you can estimate the condition. You can also compute the condition number for the previous problem, and then you see that you have to divide by something. This was 6 times 10 to the minus 5. So you will have something in the range of, so you have 70 times something with 10 to the power of 5. So we will have a very high condition number for the previous matrix. And this is clearly very far away from 1. So if you had an identity matrix, you would have singular values 1 and 1 on these two sets, or if you have a rotation matrix, and then you would have a well-conditioned matrix, which means that you can quite robustly invert the problem. And if you can't invert it, you get plus infinity, and if you have somewhat numerical instabilities, you will get a pretty big condition number. Okay, good. So this is a measure of stability or sensitivity of a matrix. And if you write in your master's or bachelor thesis about that a problem is ill-conditioned, then it would be a good idea to actually show examples that it truly is ill-conditioned, where you show either it's rank deficient or where you show that you have a very high condition number for the matrix. Well, you can actually compute these condition numbers using SVD, but if you're only interested in the condition number, there's numerically more efficient ways of doing this. But if you have the decomposition using SVD anyway, you can also get the condition number. Good. So what did I say? We have something with 10 to the power, we have something with a condition number in the range of 10 to the 5, and we have 11 to the 5 here in our condition number. And now we can show that if you, for example, take MATLAB, you can take an exercise and invert this matrix. So let's say you have this problem that is of the kind A times X equals B, then you can show that a change in B, and B is typically the data that you measure. And if you have a change of B in the range of 0.1%, then this means that you have a change in X, and X is the parameter that you want to estimate, in the range of 240%. Welcome.
Ich glaube, ich habe vorhin in der Übung meine Lupe vergessen, so eine Halbkugel von. Ist da irgendwo eine?
There you go.
Wunderbar. Vielen lieben Dank.
Entschuldigung. Good. So, our condition number is big, which means that if we have, let's say you have noise in the data, and even if the noise is in the ballpark of 0.1%, this means that you have a change in X by 240%. So this kind of problem, inverting this kind of problem, will get you very unstable results. So you should be aware of that, and if you have an ill-conditioned problem, you probably want to take measures against having such high variation in your parameter estimates. Okay, let's look into a couple of problems, optimization problems. And one thing that you typically want to do is you have some kind of matrix, you measured this matrix, and you know that it needs to have a rank of 3. And then you can compute the SVD, and then you get 7 singular values. But you know it needs to be a rank of 3, so what do you do? How do you get the matrix that has a rank of 3 and fits your problem? Yes, you set the last 4 singular values to 0, and then you multiply u times sigma times v transpose, and there you go. then you already have your solution. And now we have again this example with the previous matrix, and here we have the example that we want to set the rank to 3, so we want to remove this last element. And what do you do? Well, maybe you know that the first and second singular value also need to be in the same range, and they are clearly not in the same range with 70 and 21. So what do we do? Well, we just average them. Yeah? So we take singular value 1 plus singular value 2, divide over 2, singular value 1 plus singular value 2, divide over 2, and then we multiply with our vector here. Yeah? So, and this is a diagonal matrix. This will give us the matrix that is, in a least square sense, as close as possible to the measured matrix, and it has a rank deficiency, it has a rank of 2. So, very useful. So sometimes you know by theory, because it's a projection matrix and it maps from a higher dimensional space to a lower dimensional space, and you know there needs to be this rank deficiency, and you can put that in there. And of course you can also do the other way around. If you have a very small singular value, you can do the singular value decomposition and just set it to 1. Then you remove the rank deficiency. Then you get a matrix that is no longer rank deficient. So what's this here? Often you want to solve some kind of optimization problem, and you want to, so this is the norm of A times X. Do you see that this is the norm of A times X? So this is, Yeah, so if I take the 2 norm of A times the vector X, and this is the 2 norm, and this needs to be a vector, then of course this will boil down to A times X transpose times A times X. And this is exactly what we have here on the board, because it's transpose, you need to flip. So we will get X transpose A transpose A X, and this is what we have on the board. So this is a kind of 2 norm of your matrix. And we often do this in this lecture. We are jumping from norms to the least square problem. So here we have the actual problem that it should be solved, which is AX, so A times X equals to 0. And now I convert this to a least square problem and I end up with this guy. So this needs to be a vector of zeros. And setting up the least square problem is just, I want to have the left side of the equation as close as possible to the right side of the equation, and then I put it into a norm and want to minimize this norm. So this is the least square problem. And what we do is we simply replace this equal sign with a minus. So we do this all the time. So we have A times X, and now we subtract this vector of zeros and take the 2 norm. This is our least square problem that we seek to minimize. And now we have a vector of zeros that we subtract, and of course we don't need this any longer. So we can just go to A times X and just the minimization. Okay? And this then boils down to the previous problem. This is a null space problem with the constraint that the length of the vector X should be 1. So if you compute the null space, otherwise you would get a whole series, because it, as we've seen previously, the null space was a line. And now with this constraint that the vector X needs to be of length 1, you get to exactly 1 solution. And the solution that we will get from this one is actually the last column vector of V. Yeah? Okay. It's the rightmost column vector of V. Check this. We can also very nicely, using this kind of notation, by the way, just board is full. So let's turn off the beamer for a second. A very nice remark on the side here is we can also very easily derive the pseudo-inverse from this kind of problem. So you know that the pseudo-inverse is least square optimal, yeah? And of course the pseudo-inverse will try to solve a problem that is a times x equals some vector b. Yeah, this is the problem that we already had here. And now you can put this into a least square problem. So what you do is you do a times x minus b and then the 2 norm. And then you minimize this. And how do we minimize? How can I do a minimization? Yes, you take the derivative and set to 0. Who knows the derivative of this guy? He knows. What do we do if we want to get the derivative of some kind of matrix equation? Yes? So, where can you repeat that? Yes? Yes, you can do that. You can rewrite it into this kind of product up there and take the derivative. Or you open the matrix cookbook because it has a lot of matrix derivatives in there, and then you will immediately look up that the derivative of this 2 norm is nothing else than A transpose A times X minus B. And this is before you start computing your derivatives on your own. You can do that. It's a nice practice. It's good to stay in shape with linear algebra. Or you open the matrix cookbook and it will tell you it's this. And then you set it to 0, as we already said. So this needs to be 0. And now we can do a couple of simple transformations. So first of all, we get rid of the 2 because it's 0. Yes? Oh, we need the square root norm. Yes. Yes. Very good comment. Yes. It's the same, yes. Very good. You're in the right course. This is the advanced course where sometimes skipping is just a test if you're really watching. Okay, good. Then we have this. And we can get rid of the 2 because this equals to 0. So we remain with A transpose and this. Then we can multiply with the A transpose. And we will get A transpose B vector equals to 0. And then you can bring this to the other side. And this matrix, we can invert this matrix because it has the same dimension in terms of vectors, in terms of rows and columns. So this matrix can be inverted, and we can get to the point where x equals to A transpose A, A transpose A times A transpose B. And do you remember what this is? Yeah, this is the pseudo-inverse, exactly. So this is your pseudo-inverse. So I'm putting a dagger for the pseudo-inverse, or plus. Yeah, and we can very easily derive the pseudo-inverse here, and then we see that the pseudo-inverse is the least square optimal solution for this linear equation. Yeah, all stuff that you know. This is just a refresher. Another very nice thing is how can we get the pseudo-inverse from the SVD? The nice thing is, now let's invert the SVD. So we have U, sigma, and V transpose, and we want to invert this guy. What do we get? What's the inverse of a rotation matrix? I missed, yes. True. I'm missing, very good. Very well. Good. How can I inverse a rotation matrix? It's just a transpose. Huh? So if I try to invert this, the first thing that will happen is I need to swap the sequence. And then the inverse of V transpose will be V. Then we need to somehow compute the inverse of this guy. And the inverse of U will be U transpose. Which brings us to the question, how do I invert this? How do you invert a diagonal matrix?
Just invert the diagonal.
Yeah. So this thing here will have also diagonals, and you have 1 over the singular values. What happens if there is a 0 singular value? What do we do? We put 0, yeah. If we put infinity, we don't get a reasonable solution, so we put 0. Yeah? And this is, of course, a pseudo-inverse, because if you have a rank-deficient matrix, you can't compute an inverse, so you put 0, and this is the pseudo-inverse. I'm not showing that this is also least-square optimal. But this is just some pointers how to play with these kind of matrices, and all of you should be able to do stuff like that. Okay. Good. So let's see what we have next. Estimate a matrix such that for the following vectors, the optimization problem gets solved. So we have a set of vectors, 4 vectors, and we have a matrix. And this matrix is a 2x2 matrix. And now this kind of problem should be solved. And how do we do that? How do we solve an optimization problem? So this is now a constraint optimization. Well, let's first rewrite the first part here. So we were used to solve linear equations, right? And now we have a matrix in here, and the unknowns are elements of this matrix. This is something which is commonly we don't solve for the entire matrix, but we solve for some kind of vector. But in fact, this kind of equation you can rewrite. And this is also a trick that we often do. If we have some kind of problem, and we know how to solve for vectors, we can rewrite the equation such that our matrix is reformatted into a vector. And this is what we're doing here next. So we are rewriting our system of linear equations. So our system was bi transpose times a times bi to the power of 2. And we are rewriting this equation to a linear system. So what we want to do is we want to express this guy here in a kind of vector format. And what we do is we think about how this mapping is actually performed. And then we reorganize the elements of the matrix A into a vector A. And then you can rewrite, because this is square in B, yeah? So there will be square elements of B. But you can break this down to 4 equations where you have the elements of the matrix A in here. And you can see that if you multiply this vector with this vector, you get the same as... So remember, this is in a 2-norm and summed up. Yeah? Remember this. This is element of a norm, what is happening here. So you can rewrite this in a way that you have the elements of B in one vector, and you have the elements of A in the other vector. And now you can have multiple instances of I, and they will only add up as new lines here. And this will allow you to construct a measurement matrix. We've done this plenty of times in the last semester. Remember when we put up measurement matrices in camera calibration, or you can also estimate regression lines with this. So you remap your parameters that you're looking for into a vector form, and then you write down the measurement matrix. And here you have this measurement matrix M, and the entire problem boils down to a null space problem. And here we're then looking for the vector with length 1 in our null space. And how do we do that? Well, we do the SVD. And when we do the SVD of this matrix M, first of all, we have to construct this matrix M by using the previous vectors. Then you end with the matrix on the right side. And then you do the SVD of the matrix on the right side. And this will give you three matrices. And in the matrix V, you have then elements with, you have a column vector with 4 elements. And the 4 elements of the column vector are the elements of the matrix. So you have then to remap the elements of the column vector into this matrix form. And this will give you the solution for A. We will see more of these examples throughout the course. And if you attended diagnostic medical image processing, this is some very common trick that you put in the unknowns into a vector and rearrange your matrix into a measurement matrix that you can operate on. This way you can also estimate polynomials in using a linear estimator. Because the polynomial, so that when you do the polynomial fit, you typically observe the data points. And what you can do then is rearrange it, because the polynomial is linear in its parameters, you can do the same trick. So you can rewrite your polynomial as a matrix multiplication, and the data points are already known, and you're only fitting. So this is something which is very useful if you know how to do this. And this is also something which is quite relevant. Good, optimization problem 3. So here we want to compute a matrix, and you want to you want to minimize the distance between two matrices. And you want to search B such that it has the minimal distance to A. So for example, what you can do here is you can find an approximation. So here we have two. Why do we have two matrices here? Well, the reason why we have two matrices here is because the two matrices are images. So now A is the image on the left side and B is the image on the right side. And we want to find a matrix B that represents the matrix A, the image A, but has only rank 1. It has only rank 1. And the rank 1 the rank 1 solution will then look like this. So this is a rank 1 representation of this image. And this is also quite useful because, for example, if you wanted to get the most variation in this image, let's say you're looking for the position of the collimator blades, this is a useful tool, for example. So you can do a low rank representation of the image using this. And how do we do that? Well, you have to construct a matrix that has the rank of k. So what do we do? Well, we already know that we can get least square representations of matrices by altering the ranks. So what you do is you do the SVD of A, and then you just set the singular values that are higher than k to 0. And in this case, if we want to have a rank 1 representation, we take the SVD of A and set the singular value to 1, and you get the image on the right side. Very well. Good. optimization problem 4. And this is the Moore-Penrose pseudo-inverse. So we already talked about this. So we already showed this. Good. And this is the pseudo-inverse. This sigma dagger is given as 1 over the sigma on the diagonal. And we fill the rank deficient values with 0. And for example, you can use the Moore-Penrose pseudo-inverse to compute regression lines. So in this case, your measurement matrix would be your data points, and you have to rearrange them into a measurement matrix that only contain your M and T. And using that, you can construct the parameters. Do you want to do that? Does everybody follow how we can construct that? So you need to do this measurement matrix trick again. Maybe we do it together. Okay? Okay, what do we have? We have a line. So our line is y equals m times x plus t. And now when I observe the data, I get pairs of I here. So I have, for example, observations 1, 3, where this is the x and this is the y coordinate. And so I get essentially these observations. Yeah? These are my data points, where I have the y and the x coordinate. Or I have 2 and 6, or I have 3 and 8, and these are data points. And now I can compute the least square approximation of M and T. And what I need to do is I need to rearrange this into a measurement matrix. And I have those vectors given, so my unknowns are M and T. And now I have to rearrange that. And I can write this essentially. So what I would have to do is I have to build my vector yi, which would be, let's say this is xi, this is xi, and this is yi. And then this gives you the vector, huh? The vector y and the vector I. So you end up with having the vector y. This contains all the elements I. And then you have a matrix. And now this matrix contains exactly 2 elements. And it contains the x1 in this. So it has two elements per row. It has x1, and it has a 1 here. Okay? And then you have up to xn down here. This is your measurement matrix. And now you have your parameter vector. And the parameter vector needs to be m and t. Now, if I do this multiplication in every row, you will see that I get yi equals m times xi plus t. And now I have all my unknowns in here. And all I need to do is I need to compute the Moore-Penrose pseudo-inverse of this matrix. And all of these values here are measured. And all of these values here are measured. And I can solve for m and t very easily. So this is very similar to the polynomial trick, but this is a polynomial of degree 1 that we have here. Okay, good. So this measurement matrix trick is very useful. You will need it all the time. Then you have your linear problem, and you can solve it. Yeah. So you still need to invert this guy with the pseudo-inverse and bring it to the other side, and you have your solution for M and T. Okay? Clear what I'm talking about? Good. Then I'm hiding what I'm talking about. Okay, so this is this example. This is our regression line, and this regression line will now approximate a linear relation between the two variables. And actually, I have exactly the same thing on the slides here, but with different points. and the sides are swapped. So Y is on the right side and X is on the left side in the matrix system. And this is your pseudo inverse, and this is the resulting line equation. You can type those examples into MATLAB, and you should get exactly the same values. Some remarks on SVD. For us here, it's a black box. So we don't care how to compute actually the SVD. If you want to learn how to do that, you need to go to a lecture where you learn about numerical methods. So for us, it's a tool, and we are not discussing the intrinsics of SVD. You can compute SVD for any matrix. It's numerically robust. Complexity is m squared times n plus, so the biggest part here is n to the 3. So if you have a reasonably scaled matrix, and in most practice, so if you consider if you consider a practical example, then often you have a lot of data points and you are estimating only a few parameters. If you consider this equation here, so you have a lot of data pairs, but you only have a limited number of parameters that you're estimating. So usually there is some imbalance between the two, and this also affects your complexity. So it may be faster to compute the transposed SVD. Very well. Well, let's go to the take-home messages. So SVD is the tool for linear equations. It will work. If you use SVD, you will get some kind of solution. It may not be the most efficient solution. There may be better solutions. Sometimes it's also very useful to do an initial, to guess an initial estimate using SVD, because with the SVD solution, you get some kind of solution that you can build on. Let's say you want to initialize a method that is non-convex and you have to deal with local minima, then you might want to use an SVD to compute a first initial estimate. You have it in all standard libraries, and I would suggest to always use this as a first choice. If you want to do some kind of linear problem or you linearize a problem, then you go with SVD and you can get a very good initial estimate. SVD is probably the right answer to any question in the oral exam. Well, maybe not any question, but to a lot of questions. But be aware there are certain limitations, in particular if you're dealing with really big matrix sizes. So if you're dealing with reconstruction problems where you would have to invert matrices that have some 64 terabyte of memory, then probably you don't want to use SVD. Yeah? So there are some limitations, but it's always worth trying. Yeah? Okay, and some further readings. The original, Gene Golub. Then Carlo Tomasi's class notes are also very good on SVD. And the theory in an easy-to-read format is given here in this numerical linear algebra by Cambridge University Press. So you can buy the book on Amazon using the link on the slides. And the numerical implementation, so if you really would need to implement the SVD on yourself, you can check Numerical Recipes. So Numerical Recipes is a great book, and there's different versions for different programming languages. Numerical Recipes offers standard implementations of basically all numerical algorithms with description, and you can just implement it by the book and you would have the implementation. So quite a few open source packages are actually based on numerical recipes, and they're just re-implementations of the book in a particular programming language. Good. That's all for today. Do you have any questions so far? No questions. All questions answered. Yes, there's a question. Great. Where is the website for the videos? You can see that in the first video. So the website for the videos is, so the, it's available from Rechenzentrum and it's available from the Fachschaft. And so for the Rechenzentrum, I think it's video.rrze.uni-erlangen.de. And the FSE website is So video.cs.fau.de. Okay, in case you're watching this video, you already know this. Okay, see you next Thursday, or this Thursday.